The Book Nook on WISO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from Wright Memorial Public Library, Clark County Public Library, Tipp City Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Washington Centerville Public Library.
Good morning. Welcome to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. Back in 2000, I did my second interview with a writer who was living in Yellow Springs. Her name is Sherry Samon, or at least that was her pen name for her first three books. I Googled her and discovered that she now goes by the name Alexandria Constantinova Samon. Her first novel was called The Commandant's Mistress. It came out back in the early 1990s, and it had just been reissued in the year 2000 because it had been optioned for a film development by Patrick Stewart, best known as Jean-Luc Picard from Star Trek. And Patrick Stewart bought the option, and I don't know exactly how these work, but frequently movies are considered, but they never get made. And we were very interested in talking about this subject 26 years ago, about what he would do with the movie and how he would do it and whether he would star in it and all this. Well, I did some Googling, and I can't find any indication this movie ever was made. She did put out a 20th anniversary edition of The Commandant's Mistress in 2013. It looks like it was self-published. I don't know much more than that. I know at the time I interviewed her, she was teaching creative writing. I believe it was at Sinclair Community College. But back in 2000, we talked to Sherry Samon about her first novel and her second novel. We call it The Best of the Book Nook.
Good afternoon, Miami Valley. Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. And joining me today in a very rare double appearance on the program, one of my favorite writers, Sherry Samon. She's written a new book called Only with the Heart. We had her on recently, the day the book was published, and I love this book so much that I had to have her back. Welcome back, Sherry.
Thanks, Vic. Glad to be back.
So what has transpired since we last met? I know that was a long time ago. What's going on in your life?
Yeah, 2 weeks ago. Oh, lots of readings. I told you I finished my third book, didn't I, for Writer's Digest Press?
I'm not sure if you told me you finished it.
I finished
it. Tell us about
mailed
that.
It off. It's a nonfiction book for creative writers. It talks about point of view, literary point of view, and examines point of view in literary and commercial fiction, and then gives them advice on how to write point of view, how to write a novel, and that'll be out next year from Writer's Digest Books.
You did tell me. I remember.
Okay.
My mind is starting to function again. Sherry's new book, Only with the Heart, came out 2 weeks ago, published by Arcade. And her first book has just been reissued, also by Arcade. It's called The Commandant's Mistress. And since you were here last, I had Natalie Goldberg on the program. And she's got a book out about writing. And in the back of the book, she names her favorite books, and The Commandant's Mistress made the list.
Right. I was really flattered and surprised when she told me. She told me around Christmas. She said she wanted to keep it a surprise till the book came out in August, but she couldn't wait. So she told me, because people are always asking her what books have moved her and influenced her. And so she told me she'd listed The Commandant's Mistress, and I was very pleased.
Well, I told her that she'd have to make a double entry for you, Sherry.
To include Only with the Heart?
Yes.
Okay, that sounds fair.
I used to be shy, but I'm not anymore. I mean, why be bashful? This new book, Only with the Heart, is so different from The Commandant's Mistress. Tell us how you feel all these years after The Commandant's Mistress came out to have written such a different book.
Well, when The Commandant's Mistress first came out, and I read it again, then when it came out in paperback, I read it again, and then when it got optioned for the movie, I read it again, and all those times I read it, I thought, it's perfect, it's absolutely wonderful, there's nothing I'd change. And meanwhile, I was working on this new book. And then when the reissue came out, I read it again. So that would be 7 years after it first came out. And for the first time, there were some changes that I wanted to make. Thank God they were all minor, because I wasn't allowed to make any changes in the book unless they were typographical errors. But for the first time, I wanted to change some of the style things. I feel like I'm a better writer now, and part of it was writing just a completely different book for the second one. And I wanted to change things. And so in a way, it's kind of good that my publisher wouldn't let me change anything because of cost, because then in the future, maybe 10 years down the road, when I've got a few more novels out, when I look back, and I might want to change a lot of things, but now maybe other writers will get to see, oh, you know, you do change when you're a writer. A lot of writers change their work all the time. James Joyce used to always change his works and revise them constantly. And I'm glad in a way that I didn't get to do that. I mean, I want each book to be different. And so if I were to revise the first one now, it would sound like the way I write now instead of the way I wrote then.
I guess when you say that, I think of somebody like the poet Walt Whitman, who wrote Leaves of Grass, and then it seemed like for the next 30 years, he spent all of his time revising the poems, mm-hmm. and ultimately adding a lot of them and censoring some and removing some. And in a way, I don't think that's good.
Well, and when I was younger, I might have thought that was good. And one of the things I did when I was 22, I wrote my first, what I call my mature poem. I entered my mature phase of writing. And I threw away everything I had written before. I mean, I literally threw it away. And then as I, various times, like when I turned 30, and I think I did it again when I was 35, I did it again. And now I think, oh my God, there might have been such wonderful ideas and all that stuff I threw away. But it's, you know, it's gone now. It's in some landfill somewhere. And now I don't do that. And I want to see, even if there's not ideas, I want to see how I've changed as a writer. So now I'm interested in that kind of thing. So now I don't, I mean, I might throw it away metaphorically. I might take it out of whatever I'm working on and, you know, put it in a box in the garage, but I don't actually throw it away anymore.
Well, I'm sure that some urban archaeologist in the future will discover this treasure trove of lost Samon scripts and writing, and we'll probably just be delighted.
And then I'll be terribly embarrassed when they pull out these poems that I wrote when I was like 12 and 13 years old.
Well, you know, they do find things like that.
I know. It's probably on indestructible paper.
I was reading an article the other day, I think it was in the Times, about a guy who's one of the foremost poets from Nicaragua, and some guy was messing around in the Harvard library, and he pulled some obscure book of Argentine poetry off of a shelf, and written in the margins were new poems by this poet who had owned this book and had been sold to a bookseller and somehow ended up in the Harvard library. And, well, I'm digressing, but it's fascinating to me how we can come up with lost works, and 100 years from now, who knows, maybe they'll find your stuff.
They might.
Sherry, Only with the Heart is a book about a woman who has Alzheimer's disease. What has been the response from readers about this book?
Well, a lot of the readers who've been getting the book have had experience with Alzheimer's, with someone in the family, a spouse or a parent or another relative. So Eleanor's section of the book, which is the middle section, is written from her perspective after she has Alzheimer's. So when they first read it, apparently a lot of them feel very stressed and confused, because the first section of the book is Claudia's. It's relatively straightforward. And then they get into Eleanor's section. They get very confused about what's going on, and then they start to figure out that that's because they're in her head. And so a lot of them have come up and told me that they're very grateful about having been through it with Eleanor, because now they feel like they understand their parent or their spouse. And a lot of people have come up and thanked me and said, now I know why my father behaved this way, or why my mother did this, for example. So I think it gives them a real insight into what it feels like to be trapped in that person's head.
You're listening to the best of the Book Nook on WYSO. Going back to the year 2000, my interview with Sherry Samon for her book, Only with the Heart. And we'll continue with this archival program right after this. best of the book nook continues on 91.3 WYSO, sharing community voices through inspired storytelling. 26 years ago, I did my second interview with Sherry Samon. She was living in Yellow Springs back then. I don't think she does anymore. I really don't know where she lives. I was unable to Google that information. But she now calls herself Alexandria Constantinova Samon, and she kept writing books after this one. I think she's written 6 or 7. Let's go back into this now, talking about her first novel, The Commandant's Mistress, and her second, which had just come out at the time, called Only with the Heart.
20 years ago, would you ever have imagined that you would be here today talking about your book on the radio?
Never, never. I mean, 20 years ago, I didn't even write fiction. I wrote poetry, and I thought I was going to be this great American poet, you know, and that's how people would remember me. And my poems started getting longer and longer, and finally I had this really long 34-page poem, and I thought, well, maybe I'm trying to write fiction. And so I switched to writing novels and fell totally in love with it. I'm completely addicted to writing fiction. But even 10 years ago, if you'd told me I would write a novel one day, I wouldn't have believed it. I mean, I just never entered my mind that I would write fiction and love it. And then to get published on top of it, I never would have guessed.
Was your poetry free verse or did it rhyme or what kind of poetry was it?
It doesn't rhyme, but it has 12 syllables in each line. And when I was working on some Holocaust poems, I couldn't figure out how to break it. And suddenly I hit on the idea of writing syllabic verse because it seemed arbitrary and it seemed to be a good metaphor for what the Nazis did to the Jews and to the other victims in the concentration camp. So I just started counting syllables and said, okay, there's going to be 12 syllables in each line and just randomly breaking it. And the first few poems when I wrote them, it was very rough. And, you know, you could tell there was something going on. It was kind of jagged and the rhythm was uncomfortable. And then over the years, what happened is that I would write out a few lines and then when I would count the syllables, they were breaking exactly into 12 syllables. So somehow my subconscious incorporated that syllabic meter. And so it doesn't have rhyme, but it's all 12 syllables. I think I've done maybe one poem in 15 syllables, maybe a couple in 10, but mostly 12 is what I'm comfortable with. And then I started playing around with how it looks visually on the page. Some are in couplets, some have 4 lines, some have 3 lines, just to see how it looks. And it gives a different feel to the poem, even though it doesn't change the content. So it looks very formal, but it's actually not. And I really like the idea of the sound of the line continuing, even though physically the line breaks. And sometimes when I read it out loud, that's what people say. They say, well, we wouldn't know that was poetry. We can't tell when we listen to you. And then they come up and look at it and they say, oh, wow, it is poetry. Because I like the contrast between the flowing of the language and the physical breaks of the lines.
12 apostles, 12 eggs. What's the deal with 12?
12, I have no idea. Something just was speaking to me with 12. It's easier to work in 12, actually, than it is to work in any other number for me. And that, I have no idea. Must be something deep in my subconscious. There must be some meaning of 12. I don't know what it is.
Well, when we think of 12s, we think of a number, an ancient number, because everything now is so involved with tens, and yet the 12s stay with us. You know, we still have 12 inches. We still have 12 eggs. The 12s won't go away. Of course, in this country, we can't even really figure out the metric system.
So. Right. And for some reason, 12 just works for the poetry, for my poetry. It just, I don't know. I've never counted any of the lines in my fiction, but they probably break pretty easily into 12 syllables too. Something got incorporated in there when I was working on that over the years.
I just finished a book by Kent Hariff called Plainsong, and there's a minor character in the book in a little town in eastern Colorado who's the father of another minor character in the book, and you only see him a few times, but he clearly is suffering from dementia or Alzheimer's or something like this. As we get further into our own personal histories, we're encountering more and more people in our own lives, more and more people in literature who are afflicted with this illness. Your book, I think, is the first one that I'm aware of where it's really a main theme. Do you see this as being more prevalent in literature?
Actually, it's still not prevalent in literature, which is part of the reason the book got rejected a lot, because editors felt that no one would be interested in that as a topic. And some of the editors even said, well, if you change Eleanor's illness, then I'll be interested in the book. But I felt it was very important. I think especially people our age were very interested in that. I know it's always been a terrible fear of mine that I would get dementia, maybe because I'm so attached to language and to reading and things like that. So that would involve losing all of that. And I think that people are interested in it. And I think, again, it's also one of those topics that's almost taboo. We don't talk about Alzheimer's or dementia. If people have those diseases, we don't mention them and we don't talk about them. And the people who are caregivers don't talk about it. It's almost like there's a shame attached to having Alzheimer's or dementia. And I just felt very strongly that it needed to be talked about, and it needed to be talked about in fiction. There are a lot of nonfiction books. There are a lot of memoirs, but very few novels. I mean, I read a couple novels where, you know, the character's main concern was whether mother who had Alzheimer's would be able to vacation in the Bahamas as usual this year. And I think most of us don't have that to deal with. We have to deal with how are we going to get through every day and who is this person that I'm taking care of who doesn't remember me anymore. And that's what I was interested in. And also exploring what it must feel like to be a person who's losing her memory and losing her life, basically, because she doesn't remember it.
I can recall 30 years ago discovering a book, one of many I ended up reading, by Iris Murdoch, an incredible writer from England who ended up getting Alzheimer's, and her husband cared for her and wrote a book about it. I understand he's read your book.
Yes, he wrote a quote for the back of it. And that meant a lot to me, that someone who had been through it felt that the book was speaking to him. So I think that's what I feel is my contribution to the caregivers. They don't have to be dealing with Alzheimer's, because the book does deal with other issues, but I think our identity and forgetting our lives is a major concern for a lot of people, and I wanted to deal with that.
When I remember Iris Murdoch, the way that she wrote, it seemed hard to believe when I heard that she was ill. This incredible mind was stilled, was locked up, was not able to do that anymore. It's just such a tragic thing. And looking at your two books that I've read, I haven't read the new book that just came out, but the other new book, your first book, The Commandant's Mistress, as well as this one, you're dealing with some very difficult issues that I think all of us have a hard time facing. Why do you choose to do that? Is that why you're writing?
Well, I think, I don't know if that's why I'm writing, but those are the topics that interest me. For the first book, for The Commandant's Mistress, I just started wondering about the Holocaust. And I started wondering why it happened, why people did those things to each other. And I started to wonder, if I were in the camps and my ultimate goal was survival, would anything I did to survive be good? So could I steal food from another Jew, and would that be good if it meant I lived? And could I kill another Jew if it meant I lived? So I started to get interested in the moral questions behind it. And I couldn't think of any way to answer those questions except to write about it and put characters in that situation and see what they did. And then I did the same thing for the new book. I started wondering, after I was a caregiver for someone for several years with a dementia, who are we if we lose our memory? What does it mean to your life if you can't remember it anymore? I mean, does it mean you're not the same person? Are you dead metaphorically? And do you have to live a completely different life? And what does it mean to all the people who are around you? So I got really interested in exploring what those things mean. those are just the topics that I'm drawn to. That's what I'm interested in. And the only way I can think of to really explore it, besides having debates with my friends and my husband, is to explore it in fiction and have the characters struggle with those issues. They don't always go the way I think they should go.
In case you've just tuned in, my guest is Sherry Samon. And she returns to the Book Nook. Her new book is called Only with the Heart. Sherry, I know there was some thought in your mind that having been on this program so recently with the same book, that maybe we would not be able to find some new ground to cover. How are we doing?
I think we're doing great. I'm really impressed. You're doing a good job, Vic.
Well, you know, quite often when a guest comes onto the program, they walk out the door, and I start slapping myself saying, why didn't I ask them this question? And so this is a wonderful opportunity for me to cover new ground that maybe I missed before, because there's always some other question that just doesn't get asked or answered. And I'm really excited. I keep thinking to myself, when the Commandant's Mistress gets on the big screen, I think I very rarely go and see a film more than once, but I think I would probably go and see that film multiple times. Tell our listeners who didn't hear the first interview what's going on with that book.
Well, Patrick Stewart has optioned the book for film. You know, he's a classically trained Shakespearean actor, best known for his role as Jean-Luc Picard in Star Trek The Next Generation. He's formed his own production company to make films that he's interested in, and mine was one of the books that he optioned for film. He read it, his wife read it first. He just got married last month. His wife read it first and then gave it to him, and he told me he read it in one day and was absolutely enthralled with it and wants to make it into a film and star as the Commandant. And he said, you know, I was a little concerned because if you sell it to Hollywood, they're allowed to do anything they want, change plot, change characters, change titles. They could do anything they wanted. And so I was very concerned that this topic be treated respectfully and that it not be exploited. And he said that he would very much like to keep the two different perspectives because the Commandant tells his version of what happened and Rachel tells her version of what happened. He'd like to keep both perspectives as much as possible and also like to keep the way it's written where it moves back and forth from past to present, and he'd like to keep that. And so I felt after I talked to him that I could trust him and that my book would be safe because, you know, my book is like a child. And so I didn't even know my child was visiting Patrick Stewart, let alone living in his house. And so I was a little bit stressed about that because I thought he won't be my child anymore. You know, he'll belong to someone else. And so it's very odd to have that happen to your book, but he promised he would take good care of him if he adopted him. And so I felt very good about that. I think he's a wonderful actor and very talented, and I think that it would demand a lot of anyone to play those roles, and I think he could do a good job with it.
Coming to a theater near you, starring Britney Spears as the Commandant's Mistress.
No, please.
Yes, the Hollywood thing is kind of scary, isn't it?
It is.
My guest is Sherry Samon. Her book is Only with the Heart. I get flashes of these books. Music does this to me as well. If a song kind of catches in your mind, out of nowhere, that song bursts out and suddenly you're hearing a lyric, and I get visions of things that happened in The Commandant's Mistress, also in Only with the Heart. I think back to The Commandant's Mistress and I can remember the situation with his family living, I think, upstairs above his office, and his mistress is a prisoner in his office, and that whole bizarre, dark thing that was going on there. And then I also get flashes of when she is with some of the other prisoners who resent her and think she's getting some kind of favorable treatment, and how threatening they are to her. I get flashes, little snippets like this, that just don't go away.
Thank you. I'm delighted. I mean, I think every author wants to hear that the book becomes part of you. I mean, certainly they were part of me. And when I write the book, I can see those scenes. I mean, it's almost like someone's taken a photograph or someone's made a film of it already and I can see it in my head. And then the trick is to describe it so that other people can see it the same way. And it always comes very quickly. It's like I'm in a dark room in the middle of the night. I've never been in this room before. Suddenly there's a flash of lightning. And so I see the entire room, all the furniture, I know all the history, and then it goes black again. Now I have to describe it for other people to see what I saw. And that's the difficult part. And so if people tell me that they know it perfectly, and sometimes people have told me, oh, I saw Max on the street. It's just, I know that that person was just like Max. Or if they say, I saw a little girl who was just like Ilsa, the commandant's daughter, and she just reminded me of Ilsa playing concentration camp with the dolls, although the girl wasn't playing concentration camp with the dolls, then I actually feel very pleased because it means I've done my job well, because I've created characters who are alive to my readers. And that's, I think, every fiction writer's goal, to make characters who are alive.
My guest is Sherry Samon. Or a reader will come up to you and say, you know, Sherry, after I read your book, I can't eat chocolate pudding anymore.
They have done that. They have told me, or they can't sleep. Or, that chocolate pudding will never be the same because Eleanor's very fond of chocolate pudding. And so there's a lot of question about whether or not the chocolate pudding was poisoned with barbiturates and narcotics. Not poisoned, but to enhanced, yes. Right. Enhanced with those things to help her die.
Yes.
So chocolate pudding might make people a little nervous for a while.
Now containing 1,000,000% of the daily minimum requirement. No, I'm just kidding. The book is Only with the Heart. Sherry Samon joins us. I know we've covered this ground in our previous interview, but let's tell our listeners, the ones that might have missed the other interview, how this book is set up, how you decided to set it up with the different narrators.
Well, right now it's set up in three different narrators tell the story. Claudia tells the first part. She's accused of helping her terminally ill mother-in-law commit suicide, and she's put on trial for murder. While she's on trial, she begins to think that her husband, Sam, might have had something to do with his own mother's death. Sam tells the third part of the book. He tells about the trial and his experiences with it, and he tries desperately to believe that Claudia is indeed innocent and did not help his mother kill herself. And in the middle of the book is Eleanor's section. Just like her disease came between them and their marriage while she was alive, I put her physically in the middle of their two sections of the book because her disease does pull them apart and cause them a lot of conflict and stress. And Claudia's and Sam's parts are both written moving back and forth from past to present, associatively, the way memories work. And Eleanor's goes in reverse chronological order to imitate the way Alzheimer's robs its victims of their memory, because first it takes the current memories, then the more recent memories, and then the further back memories. So it goes backwards in her section. So the first part is when she's most ill with the disease, and then it goes reverse through when she's least ill with the disease.
You also have a style of writing in both books where you follow the thought process in the writing. In other words, as the reader is reading, just like our minds, the thoughts skip around. I found this fascinating.
Well, when I first decided to write a novel, I thought, I'll write a novel that will make me lots of money and it will make me rich, and then I can continue to write poetry, which is what I really wanted to write. So I tried to write a novel in straight chronological order. I found it very difficult. Nobody liked it. So I thought, well, I'm just going to write the way I want to write. And that's when I wrote The Commandant's Mistress. And a lot of people who read it, they said, oh, so first you wrote it straight chronological order, right? And then you cut it all up with scissors and threw it up in the air and just said, what scene, you know, whatever scene I grab, that's the one that comes next. But actually, it's maybe a little scarier than that. I mean, that's the way my mind works. It doesn't work in chronological order. So I write a scene and then I say, what happens next? And it just comes. So it doesn't come in chronological order. In fact, in the third part of The Commandant's Mistress, it's chronology because it's imitating biographical encyclopedia entries. And so I had to figure out how old they were. I didn't know when I was writing the first two sections of the book. I didn't know what year it was, how old they were, any of that kind of stuff. And I found that very difficult to write because I had to figure out exactly how old the children were, how old the wife was, how old Max and Rachel were. And so it was more challenging for me to do the chronological order than to do the non-chronological order. Someone in my family once told me that they thought that was very freaky to think that that's the way I think, but apparently it is. That's the way my mind works, so that's the way I write.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to the best of the Book Nook on WYSO, revisiting an interview I did back in the year 2000 with Sherry Saimon. And we'll continue with the rest of that interview right after this. You're listening to the best of the Book Nook on WYSO. 26 years ago, I interviewed Sherry Saimon, and we were talking about how her first novel, The Commandant's Mistress, had just been optioned for possibly being turned into a major motion picture, and the person who bought the option was the actor Patrick Stewart. And we were very excited about the prospect of this happening at the time. I don't think the movie was ever made, but we were still excited about it 26 years ago. Let's listen now as we talked about that.
Patrick Stewart is a very intelligent man. I'm seeing him looking at The Commandant's Mistress and thinking to himself, Academy Award for this role.
I hope so. He would deserve it.
I mean,
it would be a very challenging role to play.
Yeah.
I mean, to make a Nazi sympathetic, but at the same time, not make him crazy and not make him in denial. A lot of them, you know, they say, well, I was forced to do it. You know, the good man forced to do evil things. That wasn't what I was interested in. I'm interested in a more honest portrayal of what happened during that time. Many people profited from what the Nazis did to the Jews. Many people just unleashed that inner demon who has a lot of hate and anger and participated in those crimes. And so I was interested in what ordinary people do when they're in those circumstances. And I didn't, that's one of the things I did not want to happen if he does the film, to make him suddenly, oh, he's criminally insane. Because then people can excuse that and they say, oh, yes, that's why the Holocaust happened, because they were criminally insane. Or the Holocaust happened because people were forced against their will to do these evil things, which goes against the whole message of the book, that ordinary people do bad things and we are all capable of that. And so we have to stop and look at ourselves and say, this is in me too. So if I don't want another Holocaust to happen, I have to change my behavior and be aware that other people can do this. And you don't have to be crazy to commit evil things.
You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. My guest is Sherry Saimon. Her first book, The Commandant's Mistress, is back in print. It's just been published in a deluxe new edition by Arcade Publishing, which has also just published Sherry's new book. It's called Only with the Heart. Sherry, I'm wondering, what's the last book you read that really made an impression on you?
I would say Jealousy by Alain Robbe-Grillet. It's written almost entirely as if he's a camera objectively recording everything that happens. No character's thoughts are presented, just what they say and what they do. I believe it was written in 1957, but I just discovered it this summer. Fascinating. I felt like there was this little thing in my subconscious, it was saying, oh, this is exciting. This is wonderful. I want to try to write like this. You know, I bet I could do something like this. So now I've read like all of his novels and I find him just fascinating. I haven't been that excited about somebody since Günter Grass when I read his work.
The Tin Drum.
The Tin Drum, mm-hmm. Dog Years, mm-hmm. Cat and Mouse. They're experimental, but they're not too experimental. They're not so experimental that you have to turn the book upside down or hold it and look at it in a mirror to read it. I mean, I don't like that kind of experimental. I still want books to be accessible. But I was very excited about the kinds of things that they do in their books. and with the things they do with unreliable narrators and with storylines and plots. And so recently I've been doing Robe Grier's work, and I like it a lot.
Now, how did you stumble on that particular book? Did someone recommend it? Did you just find it?
Well, when I was working on the Point of View book, everything that I looked at was mentioning Robe Grier and other, they call them anti-novelists. Marguerite Duras, I'd already read her work, Natalie Surratt. And
Are they all French?
They are, actually. It's kind of amazing. The French do some incredible things with their literature, and they do it, you know, 30 years before the rest of us catch up to it. And his name kept coming up over and over, and so I thought, okay, I better read some of his books, and I just was totally in love within the first page. It was just wonderful. And Marguerite Duras' work I like very much. I had read her right after The Commandant's Mistress came out, because my editors at Harper, who originally published the book, kept saying, you know who you remind us of? You remind us of Marguerite Duras' work. And I thought, ooh, I've never heard of her.
Now, she lived in Indochina for quite some
right.
time. Yeah.
She was raised there. Uh-huh. And then her first, one of her books, The Lover, is about uh-huh. her relationship there with someone. And I got very excited about that. And I thought, oh, I've never heard of this woman. Maybe I should look at her books. Everybody thinks I write like she does.
Now, and what is it that they said reminded them of her?
Don't have a clue. I really do not know. I think she's a marvelous writer. She's a wonderful writer, has fantastic characters, beautiful style. But I honestly do not know what reminded them. Unless they just think she's a great writer and they're trying to tell me I was a good writer too. But I'm not sure. I don't see anything that's similar between our writing styles or our novels. But I like her work anyway. You know, I'm still very excited to have been introduced to her.
Isn't it amazing how other people can perceive similarities between us and someone else and we just don't get it?
Well, and when The Commandant's Mistress first came out, a lot of people would come up to me and say, you know, we can't tell who your literary influences are. Why don't you tell us who they are? And I mean, I was just stunned because I thought it was so obvious, Hemingway, Faulkner, Joyce. And I thought everybody can see that I'm influenced by these writers. But only one or two people in all the readings I did, only one or two people would come up and say, oh, I can tell you're influenced by Hemingway, or oh, I can tell you're influenced by Faulkner. Everyone else said, no, we didn't see it. And I was surprised because that was really obvious.
Definitely Finnegan's Wake.
Early Joyce.
Dubliners.
Yeah, that's right, Dubliners. Dubliners and Portrait of the Artist, not the later work.
Okay, well, the Finnegan's Wake, I guess, connection would be in the aspect of you've really got to pay attention when you read your books. You've got to be on top of what you're reading. You can't just kind of let your eyes glaze over and skip a page because you don't know where you are anymore.
It's true. And some people complained about that. They told me, you know, I can't watch TV at the same time I'm reading your book.
Oh.
Or I can't skim your book. And I mean, I think that's wonderful. I don't want them to skim. I want them to be totally and completely engrossed. I want them to be up all night saying, oh my God, I can't put this book down. There are plenty of books I've read in my life that I skim. Or, I mean, when I fly, I read books that I can skim because, you know, it takes a lot of energy to keep that plane up in the air. And so I can't read anything too heavy. But when I sit down and I really just want to read, I want books that totally make me lose track of time, that make me feel like I don't care about anything else in the world except those characters and what happens to them. And when I wrote each novel, I wrote the kind of book that I would want to read so that when I read them, I felt totally engaged and I wanted my readers to do it. In fact, when I reread The Commandant's Mistress a couple years ago, I was getting toward the end of Rachel's section, reading it. My husband came in and wanted to ask me a question. And I said, just a minute, I have to see how this turns out. And he just looked at me and gave me this really weird look. And I thought, oh, yeah, right. I wrote it, so I know how it turns out. But I mean, that's the kind of thing I was looking for. So I guess if I can do it even to me when I've written the book and I still am just turning these pages to find out what happened, then I'm happy that that happens to readers because I want them to get totally involved in the book. So I warn people, you know, don't start this just before bed because you might be annoyed with me that you can't go to sleep because you want to keep reading all night.
That's a great story. You wanted to know what the ending was. I love that. I have a philosophy of reading, and it goes like this. I don't drink skim milk, and I don't skim books.
That's good.
What's the point?
Right, right.
I can't do it.
Well, I grew up, I was reading Chaucer by the time I was 8 or 9. I was reading Shakespeare by the time I was 11. And it takes a little bit of work to read those books. And I liked it. I found it very exciting. And as I got older, the people I was interested in, it took a lot of concentration to read their books and to understand what they were doing. And I felt very involved with the book. So when I wrote mine, I thought, that's what I want. I want my readers to feel involved. I want them to feel connected. And I want them to feel connected to me and connected to the characters. And so I just wrote the type of book that I would like.
You're listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and my guest is Sherry Saimon. Her new book, Only with the Heart, just came out a couple of weeks ago. And her first book, The Commandant's Mistress, has just been reissued both by the Arcade Publishing Company. Forgive my greediness in having you come back again so soon. I hope it was okay.
It's wonderful. It's great. Think of any more questions, give me a call.
Thanks, Sherry. It's always a treat to have you.
Thanks, Vic.
And good luck with the book. You've been listening to The Book Nook on WYSO.
Don't touch that dial. We have a little time left on the program, and I'm going to tell you about what's coming up tomorrow on the show. That was Sherry Saimon, recorded back 26 years ago. Talking about her novel, Only with the Heart, her second novel, and her first novel, The Commandant's Mistress. And I Googled her, and according to her Wikipedia page, she was born in Dayton in 1956 as Cheryl Lynn Clemens, and now she goes by the name Alexandria Constantinova Saimon. And tomorrow, don't miss the program at 10:30 tomorrow morning, when Andrew Welsh Huggins returns to talk about his second book in a dynamic new series featuring a guy named Mercury Carter. And I want to give you a little example of the vibe in these stories. This is from Chapter 7, and Mercury is in a convenience store, and trouble seems to find him. Here it is. The smaller guy had a vibe like Tweedledum missing his twin. Shorter than Carter, but unlike Carter, he was round on his way to enormous, like a cartoon fire plug swelling with blacked-up water. Baseball cap on backward, really? Patchy goatee, mirrored Ray-Bans hiding his eyes. Maybe Hispanic or possibly Laotian. Direct from a central casting ethnic muscle call. Significantly, where Carter was concerned, the sag in his waistband suggested a handgun, which had Carter thinking about his Beretta in the Suburban's glove compartment and why leaving it there might have been a bad choice. The lead guy, on the other hand, the alpha, was UFC lean with tattoos running down ropey neck muscles, bare arms ribald and taut, and a gait that suggested frequent use of his fists and feet one after the other. White as a Viking on the shortest day of the year, the blue squiggles and shapes inking his face notwithstanding. UFC wasn't packing unless you counted the sheathed knife holstered in his right hip that looked long and wide enough to field dress a moose. Sup, UFC said, eyes drilling Carter. How's it going? Beautiful day. A little chilly, at least it stopped raining. Ain't that the truth? Anyway, my man, we've got some business to conduct with Nelson here. If you're wrapping up. UFC glanced at Carter's tea and candy. Slowly, telegraphing the motion, Carter reached for the Twizzlers and pocketed them in his cargo shorts. Just as slowly, he picked up his to-go cup of tea. 20-ounce cup. Carter liked tea. On my way. Excellent. Except for your truck. What's this? UFC narrowed his eyes, antifreeze blue, and cocked his head as if he hadn't heard correctly. Your truck, Carter inclined his head toward the parking lot. It's blocking the exit. UFC turned around as if he hadn't parked the truck there 2 minutes earlier. What do you know? Guess you got a point. He paused as if pondering the dilemma. He said, There's still the other way, and pointed at the second exit, the narrow one by the used car lot. Sure, except that's not the way I want to leave. UFC laughed. Oh, it's all the same, though, right? Carter met the laugh with the smile he reserved for puns, the ones he got, anyway. Thing is, I want to head east, but that way, Carter gestured at the car wash exit, takes me onto the north-south road. I'd have to turn right to get the direction I'm going, which I don't want to do. He was describing a maneuver that would have taken him no more than 10 seconds. Ah, funny guy, UFC said. And thing is, my man, he said, mimicking Carter, it's not my problem. It's still a way out, which I suggest you take, so Nelson and me can conduct our business. Carter glanced at the clerk, his face shone with perspiration. Even across the counter, Clark could smell the rank odor of fear rising off him. Carter said, regardless, I need you to move the truck. That's the way I want to leave. Carter was growing frustrated, thinking about the job before him, delivering the ruby ring to Terry Watkins, which meant finding her, which meant figuring out how Linda Stotch came into by the ring, which meant looking at the store security video for clues. These guys weren't helping matters. Regardless, UFC said. The clerk cleared his throat and widened his eyes at Carter in supplication. Please, he whispered, just go. Good advice, UFC said, winking at Nelson as if they were best pals. Sure thing, as soon as you move your truck. One thing UFC had going for him was consistency. He'd smiled throughout his conversation with Carter, smiling like a shark detecting chum. But a smile, nonetheless. He continued to smile as he pivoted slightly and nodded at Tweedledum. The companion returned the same smile, but with a knowing glance that suggested a crocodile to UFC's shark. As Tweedledum took three steps back and turned the lock on the gas station door, Carter resisted the urge to flip the man's baseball cap around. Finished with the door, the man shifted his right hand behind his back with a practice air, his confidence that of someone who'd been to more than one rodeo, which was an error in judgment. It's not like this was a fable. Slow and steady didn't always win the race. Carter clapped his left hiking boot on the linoleum floor. Tweedledum and UFC jumped at the sound of the slap. Just a little, but enough to put them the slightest bit off balance, which gave Carter the fraction of a second he needed to hurl the contents of his to-go mug of tea into Tweedledum's face. 20 ounces of hot water. Minimum temperature, 180 degrees. Or so. The man howled, hands rising to his scalded nose, lips, and cheeks as he staggered back, knees buckling. No time to waste, Carter rushed UFC, hurling his wiry frame against the young man's bulk with enough force to send him reeling backward and into Tweedledum. The blank, UFC said, recovering faster than Carter thought possible and slashing his blade at Carter. UFC cursed at the weapon as it met air, occupied just seconds earlier by Carter's torso. As Carter rolled himself over and behind Tweedledum, as UFC turned for a new attack, Carter grabbed the scalded man's gun from his waistband and tried swiveling into a firing stance. Too late. UFC's right foot lashed forward, caught Carter's elbow and forced him to drop the gun as he pushed himself backward to avoid another kick. He was in the clear only a second as UFC, moving with practice speed, thrust the knife toward Carter's left arm. The knife moved in a blur of back-and-forth thrusts so fast Carter nearly couldn't tell the weapon's point from its hilt. Carter backed up madly, grabbed his sunglasses display tree, and brought it down on UFC's knife hand, sending the weapon clattering to the floor. Gun! Carter yelled to Nelson. Nelson, watching the melee with the helpless gaze of a sailor aboard a sinking ship, didn't or couldn't move. Carter stood as UFC tossed the display stand to his left and charged. Carter reared back, which meant UFC's lightning-fast left fist brushed his jaw instead of breaking it. Carter barely had the count of 1/1,000 to feel relief when UFC's right fist connected with his shoulder, still sore from Pat's jersey crowbar strike, and Carter collapsed to the floor. He found himself lying on his side, staring at a bottom-shelf display of Pringles and something else, and running his tongue around his teeth. Carter was dimly aware that UFC had retrieved the knife, and he was thinking he should do something about the fact that he felt a pair of hands grip his heels and drag him into the open. Good stuff. From the delivery, yeah, he got himself into a little trouble there, but we're confident that he'll be okay. His name is Mercury Carter, and he delivers things for a living, and he's never failed to make a delivery. The second book, The Delivery, tomorrow, right here in the Book Nook at 10:30 tomorrow morning. Thanks for listening to your public radio station, WYSO. For the best of the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis.